Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 20th. I'm Ray Graff. Well, you know, if you're listening to this program, you probably know our fun drive ended and ended in amazing record time. So, you know, I'm not the most optimistic of fellows. I thought the fun drive would still be going. I didn't book a Vox Pop for today. And then the fun drive ended and we needed a Vox Pop. So who would email me toward the end of the drive but Rich Guthrie, the man who always steps up? So here today is broadcast bonus time for you for getting the fun drive done so quickly. It's a bird show, value added, here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie, birds, and you, coming up after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm your host, Ray Graff. We'll be discussing birds today on the program. A bit of deja vu here on Vox Pop. Rich Guthrie is here, and I swear to you, he was here within the last couple of weeks, and we did a show about birds. Rich is a veteran birder, a former NCON specialist, a compiler at one time of the Catskill New York Christmas Bird Count for the National Audubon Society. He's our go-to guy for any questions about birds. He is a popular guest, as we find every fun drive. The number to call on this program is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. Rich Guthrie, wow.
Wow.
You're here.
Here we are.
It's you know, man.
Are we on?
Do you believe the fun drive was so quick? Do you believe it?
I know. It's wonderful.
I never would have predicted it. And
but it's nice when it happens, that's for sure.
So I woke up this morning and I said, we got $100,000 to go, a little over $100,000, and unlikely that we will have a show. But I said, what happens if we do have to have a show, if things go really well? And it had been going really well this week. And I said, well, maybe I call Guthrie. He's kind of nearby. And then I said, forget it. And lo and behold, we had about $10,000 to go. And there's the email from Rich saying, you want me to come in today? Boy, I'll tell you what. That's great. And because of the schedule, you were a week late.
That's right, because I had to put off a week from...
You had something going on.
I did.
And so, I mean...
It's sort of bumpity-bump and back-to-back.
And then you'll be out again next month. So there'll be a lot of birds. The good news is we had a lot of calls in the fun drive about how a lot of people liked the bird show with Rich Guthrie. So, value added, man.
Yeah, well, the birds are still out there. It's... there's lots and lots and lots going on, lots to talk about, lots to see and do, and a few programs that I can highlight as we go along to this afternoon and bring them up.
You know, before we start, and the lines are already loading up at 800-348-2551, let's talk about seagulls for a minute.
Seagulls.
Okay.
As a lot of people will say, there is no such thing as a seagull.
Okay, well, that was my question. I'm outside about 40 minutes ago. And they're circling around, and I got to thinking, well, you know, the sea is a long way away.
Correct.
So they come up the estuary, the Hudson?
No.
No?
They're coming down from north of us. They nest up on Lake Champlain. They nest up on Lake Ontario. They nest up in the Arctic fringe of the Arctic Ocean. And here they are. They're on their way down to the sea.
Well, I often joke when we go to the beach every summer that they are the winged rats of the deep.
Well, they're there.
And they like to let me tell you what happened. I found this amusing. I stood outside for about 15 minutes to find the resolution to this drama. I guess they were serving hot dogs next door. Somebody must have dropped their hot dog on the street. No bun, just a hot dog. So, seagull circling around, tried to grab it, dropped it, and then dodged buses for about 15 minutes waiting for his chance.
He beat you to it?
Oh, no, we had plenty of food at the fun drive, okay. But, you know, it did look good. So anyway, eventually, circle to circle, circled, 10, 15 minutes in, got the hot dog, took off.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get that far with it, though. Either it ate it very quickly or it dropped it somewhere across the street.
Well, that's what they are. They're opportunistic. The opportunity is there, and they are there for it. So, they're very, very, very much happy to help out, clean up the environment.
God, that's a boring story. But I've been up since 3 o'clock in the morning every day.
Well, let me tell you, the gulls, as we prefer to call them, because truly there are some seagulls, true seagulls, that spend their life out in the ocean.
Yeah.
But most of them are along the coast or inland.
Yeah.
And the ones we're seeing right now, the ones that have been nesting up on Lake Champlain and up in Lake Ontario up by Toronto, Canada, they're on their way down through the various parking lots and fast food dumpsters on the way. Will work their way down to the beaches of New Jersey and Florida and spend the winter there and then head back home again.
You know, with all the fast food the birds eat, they're amazingly svelte.
Oh.
They don't get a lot of weight.
Well, they use a lot of energy.
Well, I suppose. Yeah,
you know, they're in fit form.
All right, Rich Guthrie is our guest. The lines are loading up here. Let's start out with Irene in Hillsdale. Irene, you're on with Rich Guthrie.
Hi, I'm so thrilled that you're back again, Rich. I heard your program last time, and I just didn't get to call and ask. So what a surprise, and how great. Thank you.
We're happy.
Yeah. So I have been observing, and I don't know if it's my imagination or my lack of observation for previous years, but it seems to me that the flocks of, I think, starlings are so much bigger than I remember usually.
Well, probably not. So I think it's a combination of timing and the coincidence of your encountering them. Starlings are very gregarious, and out of the breeding season, they gather in huge groups, flocks of maybe 100 to 1,000, or maybe even more. And they winter together in large overnight roosts where up to a million can come together at a favorable spot, spend the night, and then head out during the day to find food and forage elsewhere. So their numbers are pretty steady. It's not like they're increasing, and the encounters are more often. It's just it's just a matter of timing and coincidence. Now, also, there are the blackbirds, the red-winged blackbirds and the grackles.
Right. The red-winged blackbirds are gone by now, right?
Well, most of them are, yes. You're absolutely right about that. And the starlings will be here through the winter. And they actually like urban areas. They'll find downtown Albany, one of their favorite roosting spot. For whatever reason, the warmth or the numerous shelters that the city offers, bridges and the buildings and the like. So, yeah, they're quite happy to move into town for the winter, all of them.
Yeah, I do live in a rural area, but, I just have noticed so many. And I think they're starlings. I don't think they're grackles, but
okay.
So many more than, and when I was a kid, I remember seeing so many at a time, and I don't see that anymore.
Well, you know, the starling has this beautiful, beautiful flight when they're in a group like that. They can, there's a couple of videos online that show this wonderful undulating, almost aerial acrobatic flights of starlings, swirls of them moving in unison actually beautiful to watch. It's like an aerial ballet.
It is. It's really beautiful. I was driving along Route 23 one day recently, and a huge flock was right in front of my windshield, and then just switched direction right away. And it was great.
And one thing about those flocks, sometimes that flock is generated by the presence of a hawk. Whenever I see a cloud of starlings overhead, a tight ball of starlings in the air, I look around because there's a hawk in there somewhere, usually down in front. They're just over his left shoulder, and as a cloud, as a swarm, driving the hawk. Presumably what they're doing is sticking together and working as one mass to drive the hawk away from where they are. So it's kind of like a – so it's always a cue for me to look up and look for the hawk nearby that flock of starlings.
Irene, thank you very much for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie is our guest. Now, when birds make rapid changes in direction as a group,
yes,
do we know the mechanism? Is it an electromagnetic thing? How do they know? How do they sense?
It's almost a domino effect. There's some wonderful work that's been done with slow motion video of a flock. And birds that do this, birds like the starling that do this magnificently. And sandpipers do this. You've seen the pictures of the sandpipers where their back is dark and the belly is white. And they'll be moving through the air and you'll be watching this sort of flash from black to white to black to white to black as they twist and turn and swirl and move left, right, up, down. It's a wonderful thing to behold. But and the signal to have them all look like they're doing it all on one cue.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's sort of like very rapid. Slow-mo and very rapid signal of maneuvers, and somehow they have it so that
they don't crash into each other.
It's not right. They don't crash into each other, and it's not like one is the cheerleader, the ringleader, or the bandmaster. They all just kind of like flip.
Oh, that's
flip,
amazing.
Flip.
You see that with tropical fish too.
Yes.
Schools of fish.
Yes, right. You're right about that.
Our guest today is Rich Guthrie. And before we get to our first break and then back to the phones, Rich, this one came in from Paul in North Adams via email, who says, congratulations on the successful fund drive. Paul, thank you. And thank you for chipping in. Here's one that he has. He writes, as I pulled up to my house recently, a pigeon dropped from a tree, dead as a doornail. I took a look, and the poor thing looked like it had been ripped open. Would another bird do that, and what kind?
Well, a hawk would do that. Perhaps there was a hawk in that tree that you startled out of its feeding perch.
Yeah, he was eating.
And just dropped the prey in a hurry. And I hope that's the case. I had that one time happen while I was on the road. It happened to be a mourning dove. I picked up the carcass and I brought it to Ward Stone to have a look at. And unfortunately, that had been poisoned, and that was a symptom of poisoning. It had a direct, immediate effect on the bird that it was in flight and dropped like a rock.
Yeah.
This doesn't sound like that may be the case, but it's something to check. And the way you can tell in this instance, the one that I had, is by looking at it and seeing that it was otherwise all healthy. And
right,
so there
it was intact.
Something suspicious going on.
Rich Guthrie is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551 on this value-added Vox Pop. When we didn't expect to have a Vox Pop, we'll be back with more of your calls in a moment.
Support for WAMC comes from Stavros, Springfield, and Amherst, Massachusetts, awarding businesses and individuals for their work in service and access for people with disabilities. Offices in Amherst, Greenfield, and Springfield, Stavros.org. Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony, locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, realseafoodco.com. Kern Compliance Services, Inc., Greenwich, New York, and Mendota Heights, Minnesota, serving life insurance carriers and their distribution partners, offering Dole Fiduciary Rule Compliance Training, KernCompliance.com. Saratoga Jewish Community Arts, presenting a film of the Epstein brothers who experienced the rise and fall of klezmer music from Eastern Europe to America, October 20th, 7 p.m. at Temple Sinai. Temple Sinai, SaratogaSinai.org. And Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts. A family-owned business for over 50 years, BoydenandPerrin.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, and thanking everybody who chipped in during our amazing, fast, record-setting fun drive. The number to call here on Vox Pop is 800-348-2551. Last-minute guest, always there for us, Rich Guthrie. And, Rich, you have some events coming up.
I sure do. Thanks, Ray. This Saturday, let me start with this evening. Right off the bat, this evening at the Albany Pine Bush, my friends at the Albany Pine Bush will be presenting a program about the bird banding activity that they're doing there. Marvelous study they're doing on the resident birds and nesting birds at the and the migratory birds. That's this evening at the Albany Pine Bush Discovery Center.
Okay, question.
The answer.
How does one... You have to catch the bird and then band it. So how do you do that?
Well, there are different techniques depending on the species that you're looking for. And at the Albany Pine Bush, they're using what's known as mist nets, M-I-S-T, nets. And what they do, they sort of catch the birds as they're flying through the air, a very soft net. It's like a hammock. You go in and take the bird out and do all the studies that you're doing it and then let it go.
And so there's no harm that comes to the bird?
Oh, no. No, this is sort of like you see when a trapeze artist lands in that net.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that, you know, where it's sort of the soft landing, and it holds on to them for a few minutes so that you can have a chance to go and get them.
Well,
so that's this evening, and okay. They'll talk about how they do it. And at the Albany Pine Bush Discovery Center on New Corner Road, 7 o'clock. And they ask for pre-registration. It is free, but it is 7 o'clock this evening. And then on November 2nd at 5 p.m., it's Owls and Outdoors.
Huh.
And hors d'oeuvres. Owls and hors d'oeuvres.
Oh,
and
so
outdoors.
You had me at hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah,
okay.
Right. Again, that's at 5 o'clock on November 2nd at albanypinebush.org for pre-registration. They ask that you let them know in advance that you're going to be there.
Okay.
Then on Saturday, I will be at Poughkeepsie Public Library, the Boardman Road branch, 141 Boardman Road at 10 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning, where I'll be talking about birds of Cuba.
Okay.
Birds of Cuba, the birds, cars, and cigars.
How many have you done of this particular one-man show?
Maybe a half dozen, 8 or 10.
Yeah?
Yeah.
When will we get you to Proctor's?
Say that again?
When will we get you to Proctor's for a one-man show? Like Hal Holbrook as Mark Twain, maybe we'll get you there.
Anytime. But right now I'm working in the little libraries and the schools.
All right.
You know, and I'm open for more. If you have an outfit out there that would like to see the program and hear me talk about my adventures in Cuba with
cool.
The birds and the people and the cars and the cigars,
nice.
Let me know.
All right, Rich. And
that's Saturday at 10 o'clock to Boardman Road, 141 Boardman Road, Poughkeepsie, New York.
Okay. And that's it?
For now.
You want to get back to the phones?
Let's
do that. 800-348-2551. Jeffrey in Great Barrington. Jeffrey, you're on with Rich Guthrie.
Hi there. Congratulations on the friend drive.
Oh,
I think the lockbox is a brilliant idea.
Well, I think you're right.
Rich, I want to apologize if this question has been asked before. I don't often get a chance to listen to Vox Pop. And it's based upon two assumptions that might not be true. The first is my understanding that birds chirp, sing, warble in order to communicate with birds of their own species, and that each species would have its own unique set of calls and songs. So I've always wondered about evolution creating birds like the mockingbird or the catbird, which mimics the calls of other birds. Do they understand what they're saying? Do they, when they mimic these foreign languages of other birds?
No. Nope.
And why would evolution evolve this feature?
That's a very good question. And the best answer that I can come up with is, I don't know.
Well, I'm glad you waited on hold all this time, Jeffrey. Yeah, that's great.
Well, no, it just means further study.
Right. And what it does to the other birds, it's not as though the other birds respond to it. You know, the mockingbird is the perfect example of that. And some of the other ones, a catbird, not so much. You know, it would be really hard for another bird to recognize its song as the catbird projects it. However, the mockingbird does a terrific job. And some of them are really baffling. Except that they go, you know, they flip from one to the other. They're not consistent. Yeah, they just go maybe three or four rounds of one bird, then on to the next one. What benefit it is to them, I sure don't know. There's a lot of theories, you know. People come up with their own ideas of why it is that a mockingbird has no song of its own, but a song of everybody else's.
Now, I wonder what kind of a study you could set up that might test some theories.
That's a good question, and that's the sort of thing that people have been doing. If you look at the Cornell University website, All About Birds will have a very interesting discussion about the mockingbird song and the reaction of other birds to it, and what benefit it is to the mockingbird. It's just beyond me. It's not as though they're territorial and they're trying to keep the Carolina wren or the white ivory or the cardinal out of their territory. Just don't work that way.
And do the other birds recognize that this is an imitation?
Hard to tell, because it just goes by in such a quick, rapid response. And it's not as though it's birds of competition. It's not as though the mockingbird is trying to dissuade, let's say, another fruit-eating bird, as they are, from entering their little corner. The cardinal is not much of a food threat to them, nor is the killdeer or the phoebe or the chickadee. These are all birds that the mockingbird will imitate, but they're not really going to be competition in his niche. So it's a
mystery.
And you're
saying the mockingbirds don't have a call of their own? They don't communicate with each other?
No. Amazing. Now, the wren is not interested in what the mockingbird has. Now, if he sees the wren lurking around his little multi-floor rose bush, he'll definitely, they're very territorial. Any other bird in their territory, they will bounce out as quickly as they can, but not by song. This is a physical confrontation.
Interesting. Well, Jeffrey, this was a great question, and we could do a whole show on this. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, guys. I appreciate it.
All right, Jeff, thank you.
Have a good one. 800-348-2551. Susan in East Nassau, you're on with Rich Guthrie.
Great. Thanks for taking my call, and congratulations on the fun drive. That
thank
was
you.
Pretty fabulous.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Here's a simple question. Normally, I feed the birds from, like, November to March.
Okay.
And this year, we are going to be away for the month of January. So I'm wondering, is it best to not feed them at all, or should I start and then have that terrible gap in the middle and pick up again when we get home? Don't know what to do.
Well, it depends. And it depends on a number of things. The habitat that you're surrounded by, the bird habitat, first of all, I would say don't worry about it. Start feeding them and stop when you need to. Enjoy them while they're there, and when you're gone, they'll find other sources of food.
They'll be okay. I was afraid I was sort of, you know, abandoning them in
the midst of the cold, and
that would be worse than not feeding at all.
For most of the birds, you're just giving them a little extra easy, easy pickings.
Now, you say most. Are there some that maybe you should not feed?
No, none that you should not feed, not in my opinion. But some of them will become really attached to you. But they got to this stage in their life where they know how to find food on their own, and they will.
Okay, that's terrific.
Okay.
That's what I needed to know. Thank you so very much.
Enjoy.
Lucky you to get out of town in January. I'll tell you what, good job. Let's go to Lisa in Stockbridge. Lisa, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a flock of white-throated sparrows arrive at my house the other day,
mm-hmm.
and in that flock was a very white the bird had a completely white head, and I took a photograph of it and put it on my Facebook page, and one of my birder friends said, congratulations on seeing a piebald sparrow.
Right.
And I was just curious if you could elaborate on that, because piebald to me with a horse means the white goes beyond the eyes.
Well, that's kind of like a loosely applied term when it comes to birds, and it is an unusual occurrence. But when you have millions and millions of birds of a particular species, like the white-throated sparrow or the robin or some of the blackbirds, this sort of plumage aberration will show up every now and then. And there was one in your yard. They're very attractive, very interesting. Some of them are completely white all over. That would be rarely will you ever see a true albino. But a leucistic individual will show up where it's white all over but not be a true albino. So as unusual as they are, they occur infrequently enough that an active birder will see one or two maybe every 10 years or so.
Well, this one's been hanging around for a few days, so I've gotten to see quite a few. And he moves a lot quicker than the other birds. He stays in the bush while the rest of the flock feeds. He stays in the bush, and then he comes and darts out fast. So he obviously knows he's a different color.
Well, that part is more unusual than the fact that he is a piebald sparrow, a white-throated sparrow, because usually they have no inkling, and the other birds really don't pay any attention to them, and it don't hold it against them. It's just kind of like one of the group, and so.
Oh no, he definitely knows he's different.
Well,
no doubt about it.
Well, there are individual birds have their individual personalities, so but he's easier to recognize and pick out because he's distinctive.
Yeah.
But there may be another white-throated sparrow in that crowd that has the same reticent behavior you just don't catch on because he looks like everybody else. So there are birds that are more assertive and some birds that are more reserved.
All right.
And what did you call it that you said Lucan or some L-E-U-K?
Leucistic. L-E-U. It means whitened or something of that effect. And you'll find leucistic birds, especially the red-tailed hawk. We have these leucistic red-tailed hawks that are white all over. But not albinos.
There you go.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Lisa.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate the call very much. And over to Dave, in Saugerties. Dave, you're on.
Hello. Boy, I always enjoy this show. I'm glad I got got online here. I had a real good treat this morning. A small hawk. Can you hear me?
Sure, sure.
Yeah, okay. A small hawk ran into the screen on our kitchen window.
Uh-oh.
It didn't seem to hurt himself too badly. He flew up into a branch, and he sat there for a little while, and I got my book out. I have Audubon's North American bird book, and came up with two possibilities, but neither of them I can pin down. This always happens. I see things, and I can't quite pin down who it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's between a sharp-shinned hawk and a broad-winged hawk.
Okay.
And what I was looking at was a bird with a yellow beak and a black tip on it, and yellow legs, a little eyebrow over his eye. But the eye I saw, and he was 5 feet away when he came back to the window. He was like, I could almost reach out and grab him if he didn't have that screen there kind of blocking me.
Yeah.
He had a yellow eye. So in the book, the sharp-shinged hawk has a yellow eye. And the broad-winged hawk has, I can't quite tell if it's yellow or it kind of goes to a little orange, maybe red. And the beak looks a little wrong.
Well, let me help you out there. First of all,
okay.
the bird that would be flying into a screen in your backyard is more than likely the sharp-shinned hawk. And the reason for that is, well, one reason is broad-winged hawks are gone. They're out of town already. They're on their way to Peru for the winter.
Mm. Oh, okay, good.
So, the sharp-shinned hawk is a backyard bird feeder bird. That's what they do. So he was probably chasing down one of those white-throated sparrows or juncos or chickadees
yeah.
that you love in your yard. He was looking at it for lunch.
Chipmunks on the rocks that he was approaching. Could he have been going for a chipmunk?
Could have. They do that.
No.
But they're more of a bird hawk.
He came back out of the tree and walked over to the rocks right outside the window and
okay.
kind of sat there looking for a while.
Is that before or after he hit the screen?
After he hit.
He
was up in the tree for maybe 20 minutes, and then he came down and walked over toward where the window is.
Yeah, well, that may be where he dropped the chickadee.
Oh.
I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. And the eye color business is all about the age of the bird.
Okay.
They change
eye color.
What
about the beak? In the book, the beak is white and black, but the reality was yellow and black?
Well, hard to say. And
differences
that,
among individuals?
No. That's very consistent. But again, that's related to age, and it also relates to the seer, C-E-R-E.
Hang on. I know that's Rich Guthrie. He's battling a cold. And I got to tell you, he came here, volunteered to come on short notice, and he's sick as a dog. And you know.
No, I'm getting over it. I'm past the contagious stage.
The good news is you'll get the entire roundtable crew ill tomorrow. So that's always a plus here in Studio A.
We're good now.
Okay, fair enough. Don't worry about me. There's plenty of NyQuil for me. So anyway, to finish up with Dave's question, the yellow.
The seer, C-E-R-E, is the soft part at the top of a hawk's beak.
Yeah.
And that part will change with the color with formation through the age of the bird. But
so close to him, his beak went out, three-quarters of an inch and then down to a little black tip, and it was yellow.
Yep. Mm. Well, that would fit for a sharp-shinned hawk and probably for broad-winged hawk.
But that's your best guess, sharp-shinned?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. This is great.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. We go over to Fran in Gallatin. Fran, you're on.
Thank you. My question is about seed. The birds come to the feeder, they pick up one seed, and then they fly back to a tree or a bush. How much energy is there in one seed? It seems like a lot of effort for such a tiny little thing.
You're right about that. You're right about that. And obviously, there's the net payoff is positive. Otherwise, the birds wouldn't do it. They're not that dumb. But a good friend of mine, Dr. Bob Unick, did a study on that. He actually did a study taking this striped sunflower seed versus the black oil sunflower seed. And did a wonderful research study in his own backyard and measured the amount of energy that it took for the chickadees to come and go and take the bird seed and fly away with it and what have you. And to see whether or not the black oil sunflower seed was more efficient than the striped sunflower seed. And the bottom line was that they were both equal. But the black oil was better for watching the birds.
Oh, really? Now, that's funny. Now, they measure the amount of energy in a seed in kilocalories?
Not what he did, no.
No?
Just the weight of the seed, the amount of time they took to devour it, and the number of chickadees that were coming and going.
Very interesting.
Was, you know, a very low level, but very sophisticated in that research. Anyway, he found out that the black oil was the preferable one to use in your backyard bird feeder.
Ah, okay.
Well, friend, that's another interesting line of questioning. So we have two variants, one about the evolution of mockingbirds and one about the amount of energy you get out of a seed and whether it's worth it for the bird. Now, how much energy did your friend calculate that a small bird would take to fly down, get the seed, fly back?
This was a backyard study, sort of like on the wing, so to speak.
On the wing.
The sophistication wasn't all that great, but there are others who have done it. Another example is the downy woodpecker going after the little larvae in the gall of a goldenrod. If you look out there and you see the ball goldenrod gall, and inside there's a little wasp larvae or a fly larvae, I forget which of the two.
Yeah.
And the downy woodpecker will go around and drill a hole into each one of those, one after the other, looking for, knowing that inside there's like this soft in the inside treat waiting for them. And the energy in the middle of the winter in January to go after one of these after the other is considerably high. And some brilliant students up at St. Lawrence University, I believe it was, did a study where they took the energy level of the value of the little grub versus the amount of time and energy it took for the woodpecker to go after it. Again, net gain, otherwise it wouldn't bother.
Amazing. And I tell you what. This was a show that we decided to do on a very much the spur of the moment, and we've hit some interesting areas we rarely hit on this program.
Yeah, I think it's great. This is fun.
Rich Guthrie is our guest. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with the home stretch.
Support for WAMC comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years. QFCC.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Mango Tree Imports, a global fair trade shop in downtown Saratoga Springs, New York, featuring artisan goods from more than 60 countries, mangotreeimports.com and Facebook. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com. And Sage Wine and Spirits, Boston Spa, New York, providing worldwide sustainable and organic wines and spirits, offering weekly tastings. SageWineSpirits.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Rich Guthrie is our guest. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Before we get back to the phones, Rich, a couple of more things to talk about
here. Yeah, let's. Time to get out. This is winter's coming on. It isn't here yet. And plenty of brilliant fall days to enjoy the birds outside. With the Hudson Mohawk Bird Club on Saturday at 8 o'clock, they're going to Collins Lake in Scotia. And you can find out more about that by hmbc.net, Hudson Mohawk Bird Club, hmbc.net. And then November 5th, over to Tom Hannock Reservoir at 8:30 in the morning. Again, information on their website. November 12th, Franklin Mountain. There's a day when you might see the Golden Eagles migrating through.
Okay.
Further south, the Mearns Bird Club, mearnsbirdclub.org, will be at Storm King Arts Center, October 22nd at 8:30 in the morning. And then the Black Dirt on November 12th, again at 8:30. Over in the Berkshires, here's a good one, the To Know the Crow. This is my friend, Dr. Kevin McGowan from Cornell University.
Mm-hmm.
Will be at the Guardian Life Insurance Building, 700 South Street in Pittsfield, November 7 at 7 p.m. And that's by the Hoffman Bird Club. Also, they are doing the Berkshire Natural History Conference at Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts.
Okay.
And there you would want to pre-register with T. Tining. Let me spell that for you. T as in Tom, T as in Tom, I-N, oh, I'm sorry, Y-N-I-N-G, T-Y-I-N.
So T. Tining.
T. Tining.
With a
at
Y.
Berkshire.edu, BerkshireCC.edu.
Now, let's try that
again.
Try
to get that straight.
I know you're not feeling that
no,
well.
No, I'm in there.
That was not a good attempt. All right, let's try that one more time.
Okay, this is T. Tining at BerkshireCC.edu.
Okay.
And that's the Berkshire Natural History Conference at the Mass College of Liberal Arts.
Now, will that be on your blog?
That will not be on my blog.
But what is on your blog?
My blog is 50 Birds We All Should Know.
Ah.
And that's just the beginning of a series that I'll be running through the next coming weeks and months.
And that's at the Times Union, right?
That's at timesunion.com, the birding, Rich Guthrie.
All right, fair enough. All right, we'll get back to the phones, and Mame in Rensselaerville is next. But let's just tackle a quick email here from Chris in Cornwall on Hudson. First, two owl questions.
Owl.
You ready for owl?
Ready to go.
We are still hearing every evening what we assume is a juvenile barred owl calling for food. Is it normal for young to still be begging for food so long after fledging?
Yes. Yeah? They are lingers honors.
They are.
Yeah. So they got booted out soon because about December, the adults will be setting up their territory, and they want an empty nest to start.
So get out, Junior. All right. And then the next question is, which owl calls with just one short hoot? We think it's probably a great horned owl, but isn't their usual call longer? Thanks for Chris's favorite Vox Pop program.
Hey, thank you, Chris. Both the barred and the great horn will do a single hoot.
Single hoot.
In fact, sometimes when you're out in the woods, it's fun to do the single hoot to see who answers.
Now, you're not well, so I'm not going to make
Oh, no, we can do it.
Okay.
Watch this. All
right,
listen, here we go.
Well, that's good.
Sorry. Yeah. I hope I didn't disturb
Zach, the engineer, is ready to thrash you now. All right, do it one more time.
Speaking of thrashers, now, the owl, whoo. Now, either one. But sometimes you could do the barred owl will go have a little prolonged hoot. Whoa! And
okay.
They will answer to that as well.
All right, fair enough.
They both do the hoot.
Now, will the mockingbird do that one?
No.
No. Okay. And this one's from Roxanne. Please speak about my favorite bird, the tufted titmouse.
Okay.
I've had a pair this year, and I just adore them. Will they leave for the winter?
No. Funny thing about that, the tufted titmouse is related to the chickadee, cute as old Dickens. They're like a little mouse with a tuft on top of the head and wings.
Right you are.
And they are actually a southern bird that have moved into the area since I started birding. My first one I ever saw, my dad and I had to go to New Jersey to see tufted titmouse. And I knew right away there was one in the neighborhood without even having seen it because they have a very distinctive call. It goes like, see, we could do that whistle again.
Huh.
It sounds like it's saying, Peter, 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 Peter. That's what Peterson said in his bird guide.
Oh.
So whatever, never having heard it before, I recognize it right off the bat.
Now, does the tufted titmouse usually travel in pairs?
They travel actually in small extended family groups.
All right.
And they also buddy up with chickadees and downy woodpeckers and nuthatches.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Mame in Rensselaerville. Mame, you're on.
Hi, I was driving on a rural road out here in the Rensselaerville environs the other day, and there was a deer carcass on the side of the road and a very large black bird, I don't know if it was a grackle or a crow, feeding on it, and another very large bird that was a bald eagle.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, first, is it unusual that a bald eagle would be feeding on a, you know, roadside kill? And is it unusual that another bird would be dining with the eagle, given the fact that that bird could easily become dinner for the eagle?
Huh. Well, the answer to both questions is yes and no. The eagles, bald eagles, and out your neck of the woods or beyond down in the Schoharie Valley and elsewhere down in the Delaware Valley, golden eagles will feast on deer carcasses along the especially if it's off the road, and the blackbird could have been a crow, it could have been a raven, and they regularly will come down. My good friend Tom Sallow has been doing a very interesting program of putting a trail cam out where there's and studying the birds that come in on a carcass,
yeah,
and also the mammals. Some of the interesting creatures that come in at night will be bobcats and coyotes and foxes and even neighborhood dogs on the run and kitty cats.
Okay. Well, there you go, Mame. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
All right, now let's go over to Maria in Amherst. Maria, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm calling because I'm an avid bird lover, and I am fortunate enough to have a number of chickadees and nuthatches and bluebirds and blue jays and all the different songbirds come to my yard for my berry bushes, and I do put up feeders, but mainly there's a lot of hemlocks and berry bushes. And I'm sort of facing a problem right now because I have a new neighbor come in with four nuisance predatory cats.
Ow.
And no matter how much I ask the woman to please, please, please keep her cats inside, she said, well, it's the law of nature. Every day, I've taken my bird feeders down because I don't want to, and anything that I do, I put, you know, in areas where there's no little, there's no way for a little cat to get under a tree and surprise a bird. But I don't know, like, how you deal with the nuisance cats. And I know that for a while there was a law regarding nuisance cats. But my songbirds have, this last summer, since she's moved in, I find more, and I don't, it's not, they're not birds that have been eaten. They're birds that have been toyed with and tortured. And how do you deal, like being a bird lover, how do you deal with people who, with the disproportionate amount of cats per square?
I hear what you say, and I really, really, really feel sorry for you. Unfortunately, not as with dogs, where there are plenty of regulation regarding unleashed dogs on the loose. There is no such stuff out there regarding cats. And it is an intrusion. It is a violation of your privacy and your rights. But there is no easy mechanism. Perhaps you could go to your animal control officer in your community and file a complaint. Depends on if there are any, which I doubt very much. Local ordinance.
I actually tried the animal complaint. The animal mm-hmm. officer has three cats of her own.
Yes, right.
So that it. Cats are. That's the law. It's the same thing. It's the law of nature.
Okay.
Well, it's not. It is an unnatural imposition on nature. And as you know, or if you've heard the program before, you know I am not a fan of outdoor cats, free-roaming cats, or cat colonies, feral cat colonies, or any of that sort, because they are a huge impact on nature, and especially birds and small mammals.
All right, Maria, thank you. Let's go over to Douglas in Saratoga Lake. Douglas, you're on with Rich Guthrie.
Hey, thank you, Ray and Rich. Ray, I have a quick story here, by the way. I wrote down, this station is the relevant emotion station and the most valuable content station. I've traveled a lot. You guys are to be congratulated. Oh. You're fundraising everything. Aside from that.
Thank you.
Egrets versus herons, Rich.
Yes.
I we see quite a few up here, actually, on the outlet to Saratoga Lake. It's called Fish Creek, and I see one of the two. You could offer a third, and they will fly down along the creek between the trees like they are flying a jet plane. I'm utterly amazed. But I got to tell you a quick story. I had to go up to Glen Lake yesterday to help a friend out, and they built a small pond, a man-made pond for these large goldfish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, their house in this little pond is a good ways away from the lake, but what they've been getting lately is some of these egrets will actually come up into the woods near where their house is, and they'll come up near the pond, which is covered with, like, chicken wire to keep the leaves and stuff out, and they are trying to pull the chicken wire up and go for those big goldfish.
What can I tell you? What can I tell you?
It's amazing.
Herons and egrets are like that. They eat fish and they eat other things. They eat frogs and polywogs and snakes and small mammals. Yeah. If a water shrew should happen to be swimming by, there it goes. It's easy pickings. I actually, on the way in this morning, I saw a great blue heron out in a grass field along the shoulder of the road.
Yeah, they're great.
Probably working for mice that might be out there.
Huh.
So they're omnivorous.
Is there a key difference to look for between a heron, or do we have mostly herons or egrets in our area up here?
No, there isn't. There's a lot. They're both in the same family, and it's just a taxonomic or name difference between the two of them, in my opinion. Now, it's sort of like pigeons and doves. It's not as clean cut as, let's say, a goose and a duck. But there are there's a lot of overlap in the naming of herons and egrets. The great white egret and the great white heron, or the cattle egret and the little blue heron. They're all, you know, there are a lot of similarities, family resemblances, and overlap in naming. So I think probably just leave it at that. It's just as it is. And herons and egrets are all cousins.
All right. Let's go to Judy in South Egremont. Hi, Judy. You're on.
Hi. This is a very, it's a long shot because I didn't have binoculars.
Yeah.
But I was sitting in a garden surrounded by woods, and I was sitting beside the garden, and a kind of burnt sienna-colored bird, a little bigger than, a white-throated sparrow.
Mm-hmm.
The only unique thing about it, because I didn't see its bill up close or other characteristics, is that it flicked. Not at first I thought, God, could a Phoebe be coming back? But it wasn't that flick of the tail. It was its body and its wings. It just kept kind of opening up and closing.
Twitching.
Flicking often. It went down to the ground in a leaf mulch and got something there, and several times went to the top of fence posts.
And this burnt sienna coloration, is that kind of, refresh my memory, that's a brown, that's a tan brown?
It's a kind of a
burnt,
a beautiful brown that's not a dark brown, but a little reddish, but rusted.
And what about any other markings, like white stripes or black spots?
Well, I didn't, there was nothing visible without binoculars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is the flicking anything, you know, like this quick movements with its wings while it was still, while it was perched?
How big was it?
A little bigger than, say, a white-throated sparrow.
Okay, well, I'm going to suggest that perhaps it was a cardinal or, well, you see, the uniform brown coloration, a female cardinal being a brown coloration like that?
No, it's too small.
Huh.
Too small for that.
A mystery.
Yeah.
It is. And it's going to hit me as soon as I get in the car and I'm on my way back home.
Can you get a picture, Judy?
No, I didn't have the camera handy or the binoculars.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm perplexed.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to have to, like I say, or my friend Bill will call me up later on. You say, you're an idiot.
Well,
that was so-and-so.
What's your email address, Rich?
Because of the flicking, would that be a giveaway?
It would be if I, but with a little more information. There's not many birds that will do that. And you're right about the Phoebe, but they don't really flip their wings out like that.
That's why I knew it wasn't, because they pump their tail.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, the email address, if it comes back and you do have your camera ready or somebody else out there. By the way, now's the time when rare birds show up, and this may be one of those creatures from the Southwest Desert, like the Roadrunner or something.
There you go.
It ain't going to be a Roadrunner, but Richard P. Guthrie at gmail.com. That's my name. Richard P. as in Peter Guthrie, Guthrie, at gmail.com. I love to get the pictures and elevate the quiz to that level, and we'll get right back to you on it.
All right. Very quickly, about a minute left here. Andrea in Wilton. Andrea, you're on with Rich Guthrie.
Hi. I have a cedar-sided house located in the woods. I have three very large feeding stations primarily geared towards woodpeckers, suet logs, suet feeders, mealworms, everything. My question is, this past summer and fall, The hairy woodpeckers have diverted their attention from my feeders onto my cedar house.
Oh, boy.
And they've actually done some damage.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything I can do to divert them back onto the feeders? I even leave dead trees standing for them. So it's a woodpecker haven here.
It is.
But my house is starting to suffer, and I was wondering, is there anything I can do?
Well, the only reason why the woodpecker is interested in your house is it's got more or easier food to get at.
Oh, that's not good.
That's not good. During the spring, they might be out there just drumming on it, using it as a sounding board, a percussion instrument. But away from the nesting season and persistent and actually drilling a hole, not likely the case. So I would say that I would investigate to find out what's got their interest and attention.
Rich Guthrie, that is where we will have to leave it. You're not feeling that great.
I feel great now.
Man, it was so good to have you here. Thank you here for being on the program. First one after the fun drive. And thanks to everybody who pitched in during an amazing 3.5-day fun drive. Support comes from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, protecting the land that protects the lake, offering more than 32 miles of trails for hiking, birding, and outdoor exploration. HikeLakeGeorge.org. George Heigl, Cowan's representative, specializing in evaluating marketing, buying, and selling of jewelry, fine art, historic firearms, American Indian art, and more, 518-396-7974. And J. Rich Clothing, Northampton, Massachusetts, fashion-forward menswear by Theory, Patrick Assaroff, Robert Graham, and Diesel, Main Street, Northampton, jrichclothing.com and Instagram. Thanks again to Rich Guthrie for being here. Thanks to everybody who pitched in during the drive. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Deb Malik. I'm Ray Graff. Well, we celebrate the fun drive in style tomorrow. Tomorrow it's beer and pizza with DeFazio's Pizza and Druthers Brewing. Away we go. Stand by for news.